This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Thanks for being with us today. If you happen to be watching college football or Wheel of Fortune in a swing district in the final months of the 2016 presidential election, you might have seen one of these commercials from the National Rifle Association.
She keeps a firearm in this safe for protection, but Hillary Clinton could take away her right to self-defense. And with Supreme Court justices, Hillary can. Don't let Hillary leave you protected with nothing but a phone.
Followed by this ad from the Donald Trump campaign.
A vote for Hillary is a vote for more of the same. A vote for Donald Trump is a vote for change that makes America great again.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
A slew of negative Clinton ads may have seemed normal in the lead up to November, but an investigation by The Trace and Mother Jones found that the NRA didn't follow the Federal Election Commission rules on keeping their election strategy and their $30 million of spending separate from the Trump campaign. And that goes against the FEC's rules about what they call coordinated communications. Mike Spies is a staff writer at The Trace, and he joins me now to share his investigation. Mike, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So this coordinated communications is kind of a really difficult term for what? What did they do wrong?
On its face, the way it works is if you're an independent group, you're allowed to spend as much money as you want advocating for a particular candidate. That's what independent expenditures are. But once those expenditures are coordinated with the campaign you're supporting, or I mean, another way of saying it is once you start sharing information or strategizing about ad placement or messaging, that kind of thing, those expenditures are no longer considered independent and instead are viewed as in-kind contributions, which are subject to very strict limits, like, for instance, $5,000. You can't go over that.
So is it illegal for the NRA to have spent $30 million to back Trump in these ads? I mean, what raised the red flags here?
So it might have been illegal. What we don't know yet. So there are certain things we don't know. What we do know is that based on the investigation, the NRA and the Trump campaign were using the same operation. And as we dug very deeply into FCC records, we also saw that within that operation, four of the same people were being used for placements on both sides, meaning that these public files that live within the FCC database contain things called NAB forms. And those are the forms that authorize ad placements. And there are many instances in which one person was authorizing the placements and signing them as an agent for either entity, for both the Trump campaign and the NRA.
So let's talk about this group called National Media. And I don't want to get too far in the weeds on how the advertising, quote-unquote, ecosystem works, because we'll be here for 3 days. But National Media, who are they and what did they do? What's their link with the NRA and the Trump campaign?
So National Media is a very prominent ad placement firm in D.C., but what they also have is what's called a DBA, or a Doing Business As title, and that's called Red Eagle Media Group, and it's just another name for National Media. And in 2016, the NRA placed most of its ads through Red Eagle, and then at the same time, National Media has another affiliated entity called American Media and Advocacy Group, and that's what the Trump campaign was using. So what you had, again, was the sort of same operation working for both sides. And then within National Media, there were four folks, one the CFO, two senior media buyers, and then another lower-level employee, but someone who still had an important role at the firm, who were either acting as representatives for both the Trump campaign and the NRA, or were, as I said earlier, actually authorizing the placements and signing paperwork for both.
And do we know, we talked a little bit about this in the introduction, but these ads were targeted. When we talk about placing ads, generally what advertisers do is they'll say, okay, we want to target this group of people in this area. And so they'll show ads on that specific network or that specific website. Was there a specific demographic that these ads were targeted at?
I mean, certainly at different times they were aiming to hit different demographics. The sports syndicator that you were just talking about, or that sort of let us in, is a really great example of what a coordinated communication could look like. So that was done through a syndicator called Raycom, which basically airs college football games on some 120 stations across the country. So in late September, both the NRA and the Trump campaign, through these national media entities, purchased ad space for between 6 and 7 football games. 5 of them were the exact same games, and whenever they were the exact same games, If the NRA bought two ads, then the Trump campaign bought one ad. And if the Trump campaign bought two ads, then the NRA bought one ad. And then in the instances where the NRA was in games that the Trump campaign was not, the ratio still persisted in that the NRA was in two games, whereas the Trump campaign was in one. So the idea here is it's a force multiplier. It allows you to maximize your resources. You can spend way more efficiently. You can spend less if you know you're going to be in the same place. You can put more, as Rick Wilson, a strategist, told me, you can put more fire on the target if there's a particular demographic that you really want to reach. And you can take advantage, if you're the campaign, of what's called the lowest unit rate. You don't have to spend as much as independent groups do. That's just the—
Because you're buying in bulk.
Right. You're buying in bulk, and also you just, I guess, you get certain privileges for being a candidate.
We're seeing a lot of high-profile campaign finance violations that could pose a serious threat to the Trump presidency. Does your reporting give us a broader view of what kind of campaign the Trump organization was running?
With respect to the NRA, no outside group spent more money in support of the Trump campaign. And the big thing in 2016 was that most independent conservative groups stayed out. So the question was, why did the NRA get in when everybody else was saying, we're not going to do this? And why did, and not that they just got in, but they got in a much bigger way than they'd ever gotten in before. This was the most money they've ever spent by orders of magnitude on a presidential race.
And just to be clear, have they responded to any of this? Has the NRA responded to any of your requests for comment on this?
Or no.
They have nothing to say about it?
The NRA, the White House, anyone that was connected to this story did not respond to multiple requests for comment.
Where do we go from here, Mike?
Well, I think where we go from here is a complaint has been lodged with the FEC. In order to, if in fact there was coordination, the only way to prove it for once and for all, I think, is to actually get emails and that sort of thing. So if the FEC decides to take up an investigation based on the complaint, that means that they can get internal records. They can ask for them. The House, which is now going to fall to Democratic control come the winter, could do the same thing. They have subpoena power. The DOJ also has the ability to open its own investigation to truly get to the bottom of it.
Mike Spies is a staff writer at The Trace. Mike, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
There's another thread that ties the NRA, the Trump campaign, and the 2016 election together. A Russian woman named Maria Butina. This week, she entered a plea deal with U.S. prosecutors for conspiring to act as a foreign agent. According to the deal, Butina used her cover as a gun rights activist to infiltrate the NRA and circles of Republican Party operatives in an attempt to influence policy and strengthen ties between the U.S. and Russia. Josh Meyer covered the Butina story for Politico, and he now writes for Time. Welcome, Josh.
Hi, Tanzina.
So we mentioned that Butina is pleading guilty for working as an agent for the Kremlin in the United States. But what exactly was she doing in her attempts to gain access to the NRA and to these Republican circles?
Well, that's a good question, what exactly she was doing. I mean, what we know about her, and we assume that the federal authorities know a heck of a lot more than we do, is that she was what's known as an agent of influence, which is somebody that they believe was sent by the Russian government here to the United States to gain access and influence within important institutions and report back to her alleged handler in Moscow, who was a guy named Alexander Torshin, who's a very close associate of Vladimir Putin's. He was the deputy central banker and somebody who had very close ties to the NRA, and he helped Butina get ties to the NRA too. And through those ties, they also got ties to the Trump campaign, to the National Prayer Breakfast, and a lot of other influential Republicans and conservatives.
What about the NRA? What role did they play in this? And have they responded to any of these allegations?
I've been writing about this extensively for at least 2 years, and they have not once responded in any form except for to deny whatever has been publicly alleged. But, you know, that's the real wild card here, is what was the role of the NRA and whether they were a witting participant in any of this stuff or if they were a vessel through which the Russians were trying to pour money and assistance into the Trump campaign. And one of the black holes in this is that the NRA has an offshoot because it's a nonprofit, is allowed to donate money without having to disclose any of the details of it. So the question is, was any of that money being used to help the Trump campaign in furtherance of a collaboration between the Kremlin and the Trump campaign to help Russia for instance, get off out from under sanctions and get other policies that were of interest to it in Washington.
We're seeing a lot of folks who were involved with the administration and with the campaign slowly entering guilty pleas. Butina previously entered a plea of not guilty. What changed?
I think that she, you know, the prosecutors and the FBI leveraged her and got her to cooperate. One of the things her lawyer has been saying all along is that they put her in solitary confinement and that she's gotten depression and a lot of other medical and psychological problems as a result of that. And they might have just, you know, wore her down or broke her down and gotten her to cooperate. But this is hugely significant. I mean, this is one of the first times in recent memory, if not the only time, where you have a Russian, accused Russian agent or spy cooperating with the U.S. government in real time on an ongoing investigation, certainly one of this magnitude.
And given that, how unprecedented that is, I'm wondering, has Putin responded yet?
Well, he has, and he said that he doesn't know who she was, and he said that it was almost Trumpian in style. He said, you know, I've asked around and nobody seems to know who she is, which is kind of ironic because there have been 6 or 7 diplomatic visits by high-level Russian officials to Butina while she was in custody in jail. There have been a couple of diplomatic demarches where they've demanded assistance from the various highest levels of the Russian Foreign Ministry to the highest levels of the State Department, to Mike Pompeo, actually, at one point. And they even had her avatar as the public face of their foreign ministry Twitter and Facebook feed. So it's hard to say with a straight face that they didn't know who she was. If she wasn't, why was she so important to these people in trying to get her freed?
Do we know whether Butina had any direct contact with the Trump campaign?
Oh, definitely, yes. I mean, she spent a lot of time trying to access them at the Republican convention in 2016. She was interfacing with a lot of these, the advisors and campaign people. She and Erickson reached out, as I reported in Politico, a year before it had been publicly disclosed to the Trump campaign, almost days after Trump had launched the campaign. They were trying to set up meetings, if not with Trump, then with senior Trump officials. And then right after that is when Butina asked the now infamous question of Trump at a campaign rally about Russia and what his positions were and whether he supported the lifting of sanctions. So it looks very much like it was a premeditated, perhaps collaborative effort. And I know that that's something that the authorities are looking at.
Josh Meyer is a journalist covering national security. Josh, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Republicans could bring up this bill, if they had the votes, immediately and set the tone for what you want.
If we thought we were going to get it passed in the Senate, Nancy, we would do it immediately. We'd get it passed very easily in the House. Nancy, I'd have it passed in 2 seconds.
One of the stories making the rounds on social media today is the fallout from President Trump's meeting with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer yesterday, specifically the interaction between Pelosi and Trump.
I need 10 senators. That's
the
problem.
Mr. President, you have the White House, you have the Senate.
I have the White House. The White House is done, and the House would give me the vote if I wanted it. But I can't because I need, Nancy, I need 10 votes from Chuck.
All right, let me say something here.
Let me just say one thing. The fact is, you do not have the votes in the House.
Nancy, I do. And we need border security. Nancy,
Nancy.
He called her Nancy. She called him Mr. President. The president threatened to shut down the government, and the top Democrats vehemently pushed back, all on live television.
If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, whether it's through you, through a military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay,
absolutely.
Fair enough.
And
we
I am
disagree.
Proud, and I'll
we
tell
disagree.
You what, I am proud to shut down the government for border security.
It was a rare look at the dynamics of closed-door meetings in Washington these days. What did you think of how the president handled the meeting? What about Pelosi and Schumer? Is this the kind of public discourse that's good for dialogue, or is it just arguing?
Hello, my name is Ed, and I'm calling from North Charleston, South Carolina. As a member of the public, I think that I don't mind this. I don't mind seeing, you know, the nasty side of politics because it just clarifies what I already know about it, you know? So I think it's a great opportunity that we got to see this. You know, some people are going to disagree with it, but politics is a nasty business. Our country is a tough country, and I think meetings like this is what keeps us going.
Hi, it's Kevin from Manchester, New Hampshire. I absolutely loved that. I wish they would do that more. I mean, I would really, really like to go toe-to-toe with Chuck, baby, with his smug look. And it shows just how nasty the Democrats can be. Instead of putting something up there, they say no to Trump, just period.
And here are some of your tweets. Adenduyan tweeted, "Nancy Pelosi is exactly the kind of leader I want fighting for me, and I'm not even a Democrat. Go, Madam Speaker, go." And David Allen wrote, "I think President Trump should stand firm for the money needed for the southern border wall. Democrats need to give it up for the betterment of the country." Keep telling us what you think. We're listening. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. On Monday, U.S. Capitol Police arrested more than 130 protesters outside the offices of Democratic Representatives Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer. The demonstrators gathered on Capitol Hill to rally support behind what is being termed the Green New Deal, a plan to drastically overhaul the United States economy and infrastructure in order to combat climate change. Plans for a Green New Deal are still in their early stages among Democrats, but one policy proposal currently being floated is a draft created by Representative-elect Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and it's starting to gain momentum. To learn more about the Green New Deal, I spoke with Alexander Kaufman, a climate reporter for HuffPost.
The core components of the Green New Deal, as it stands both in the proposal for a select committee and in the sort of vague policy stance that a lot of different lawmakers have gotten behind, is 100% renewable energy within the next decade to two decades, you know, a complete overhaul of the economy to begin to wean it off fossil fuels, and some type of mechanism to make this transition equitable for people both in industries that would be impacted by that economic shift and in people who have been left behind in the economy that we currently have. So it's a very broad proposal. It's really more of an umbrella for a lot of different policies that fit into it than it is any one specific policy idea.
And we keep hearing, you know, about how bad, I'm sure the momentum behind this is increasing because of what we keep hearing about in terms of climate change. Like, we are not far away from seeing real serious impact here in this country and around the world. Can you explain to us some of the groups that you think, or at least the policymakers think, that this would benefit?
Well, it would benefit the whole country and the whole world ostensibly to begin with. I mean, I think it's important to understand that while this policy has begun to be talked about as a sort of moonshot policy and as idealistic, it's really not. I mean, it's the first proposal that has come out that is on the scale of what scientists the world over say needs to happen if we're going to avert, you know, warming beyond 2.3 degrees Fahrenheit, when cities like here in New York, it's going to be a very different type of place than where we grew up and where we live now. So it's critical for averting those things. But overall, you know, the idea that you could basically set aside huge amounts of federal stimulus and then give that to communities, many of which have suffered the worst from the fossil fuel economy that we have now. I mean, there's a term in activist circles called frontline communities, which are overwhelmingly communities of color. They are almost entirely poor, and they deal with health effects from fossil fuel plants, be them refineries or coal plants or other types of facilities. You have higher asthma rates, higher rates of cancer, and so many other health maladies from that. And, you know, a lot of these people don't have a choice of where to move. A lot of them have to work for these same facilities that are making them sick. So in an economy like this, where you are not only, you know, forcing the adoption of renewable energy on a large scale, but also providing training in a large way to help people to enter those industries, you could see a lot of people who have suffered with how things are now not only being able to live healthier lives, but live more fulfilling lives with careers in industries that are improving both the planet and the country.
So far, this doesn't sound like a bad deal, but it's become politicized, and I'm interested to know why and how that's happened.
Well, we just saw the fossil fuel industry spend upward of $100 billion to sink, you know, three or four different policy initiatives in states out west that would have discouraged the use of fossil fuels in those states. You know, you had the carbon tax in Washington, you had a renewable energy standard in Arizona, and you had an anti-fracking regulation in Colorado. And the industry spent tons and tons of money to make voters believe that that would cost them jobs and to make people feel that those were completely untenable for the future success of those states. So this industry is not going to go down without a fight, and they have a lot of allies in both parties that they've given a lot of money to, and they have erected this network over the last 30 years of think tanks and organizations that have had a clear and indisputable strategy of discrediting climate science and of seeding doubt over how severe this problem was. So the idea that after all that they've done, you know, now you're finally seeing oil companies come around and say, oh, you know, in fact, we are going to be an energy company, and we're going to have more renewable energy by 2050, and we're going to do all these things, and, you know, we're going to have an impact on the Paris Agreement and on the negotiations that happen with that. This is not an industry that's going to cede power in any kind of way. And so I think that a lot of efforts to politicize this are going to be rooted in what that industry wants and in the allies that it's cultivated over the past few decades.
Now, given the, as we mentioned, the political headwinds here, who's really behind this and who's just giving it lip service?
There are a handful of groups that have been really spearheading this movement in Washington that has been, you know, rallying the grassroots for what Ocasio-Cortez wants to do. One of them is the Sunrise Movement, which is a kind of youth-focused climate justice group. Another is the Justice Democrats, a group of, you know, former Bernie Sanders people who have been behind a lot of progressive campaigns, including Ocasio-Cortez's. And those groups have been very, very diligent about making sure that the people that say that they're signing on to it are actually signing on to it. Just yesterday, Representative Joe Kennedy said in a tweet, I'm on board with this. I stand with the Green New Deal, and said it on Twitter, and people were excited. And immediately you saw tweets back at him from their official accounts. We're really excited that you're on board, and thank you for backing this. However, we need to know, are you just behind the vague policy idea, or are you prepared to vote for this resolution that we have? And he responded in kind and said, yes, and I'm prepared to stand with the resolution. And sure enough, his name was added as the 31st to the list of representatives that they have backing it. So these are very serious organizers. They are pursuing a very confrontational style of organizing, but it seems to be getting results, and it seems to be really building a concrete coalition with the names and faces of people on different things that they're posting online. And, you know, they're doing a lot to really hold the people who say that they're behind this to account.
One of the interesting things, a couple weeks ago, we had on the show three different young people who were all from different political ideologies. And what struck me was that they all agreed that climate change was an issue. These are all, young college students. And my question is, do you think that given that younger conservatives also feel that that climate change is serious, could they get on board with this Green New Deal?
It's an interesting question, and not one that I've personally explored in my reporting so far. I will say that, you know, there within the conservative circles, there are people who consider themselves climate realists and are strong advocates for some type of action on climate change. However, that action has been limited and remains limited, as far as I can tell, to market interventions. You know, that is the kind of dogma that the conservative movement has long preached.
I.e. carbon tax.
I.e. a carbon tax or some type of carbon pricing scheme. You know, you could also have cap and trade or something like that. But, you know, that is what these groups generally advocate. And unsurprisingly, when you see the PR from oil companies, it's also that we support a carbon tax. And, you know, I think.
And yet they get voted down.
They get voted down.
I'm trying to understand this.
It's not a popular policy. I would imagine that as something like this gains more momentum and as the debate over the Green New Deal shifts from a Green New Deal or not, but what kind of a Green New Deal, that you probably will see more conservatives, particularly young ones, get on board and try to dictate what that looks like. But I think that there is reason to be skeptical about efforts for that now, given the kind of ideological constrictions that people in that movement have when it comes to an issue like this.
Alexander Kaufman is climate reporter for HuffPost. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Go to omahasteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
In the southwestern Puerto Rican town of Adjuntas, a small community center has been powered by solar energy for almost 2 decades. It's called Casa Pueblo, and after Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico last year, the lights at Casa Pueblo stayed on while most of the island plunged into darkness. Residents were able to charge their phones, store food, and use its electricity to power critical medical devices. Now, as Puerto Rico rebuilds its power grid, which federal officials say could cost over $30 billion, solar energy is being seen as an alluring alternative to guard against future blackouts. And Casa Pueblo is on the front lines of that change.
What we're doing is calling from a bottom-up process in which people can actively engage in the transition to solar power and to show that that transition can be done.
Arturo Masoldeya is the associate director of Casa Pueblo, and he's featured in a new documentary, Paris to Pittsburgh, that explores how Americans are responding to climate change. And he began by telling me how Casa Pueblo is lighting up Adjuntas.
We have done a barber shop here, 5 grocery stores, a pizza place, a restaurant. We're doing warehouses. We're doing full houses in Adjuntas in order to change our energy landscape.
So solar energy is not a new thing for Casa Pueblo. How has it changed and become more important since Hurricane Maria? Because what you're saying is you're doing an energy revolution.
So in 1985, we decided to buy an old house, and it became the center of our organization. And since 1999, it has been running on solar power. After stopping the open pit mining proposal, we proposed a new forest, Bosque del Pueblo, and after that, Bosque La Olimpia. So we are actively engaged in conservation initiative and the protection of biodiversity. And in doing so, we find out that the energy agenda was a critical component to be included for conservation of nature. So that's why Casa Pueblo had been running with solar power. We upgraded our system in 2007, and after the hurricane, our solar system was intact, and we were able to reopen the day after the hurricane and start giving a humanitarian service to our community.
I wonder if the people that you were serving after Hurricane Maria, was there a moment where people said, wait a minute, solar power is not just a fad, this is critical, this is part of something that helped us survive through Hurricane Maria? Did it change the minds of other Puerto Ricans?
Absolutely. After the hurricane, we organized a campaign with the diaspora of Puerto Ricans in the U.S. To light up Puerto Rico with the sun. So the idea was to give people solar lamps to help during the crisis with illumination, but also to show them how easy, how simple, safe was to embrace solar power. Other people were coming here to get help. And for example, Maria Medina was a dialysis patient and she needed to run her equipment at home. So we decided to do 10 houses that were that had special medical needs to power, again, a dialysis equipment, a respiratory machine, and other devices. And what happened is that they don't see Casa Pueblo any longer as an exotic solar-based institution, but they see now Casa Pueblo as a new reference of things that can be done to free ourselves from the grid and the power authority, and not only as an opportunity, but basically as a necessity of the people to generate energy at the point of consumption. So we are seeing a transition. People are more receptive. A lot of people are coming to Casa Pueblo to see how we're doing the energy generation at the point of consumption. So I guess we're in the middle of a transition, and we want to push for energy self-sufficiency for the island, to move away from fossil fuels, because we're vulnerable, because it is an obsolete infrastructure, and seeking energy self-sufficiency is not only good for the environment, but also to improve the quality of life and build resiliency for the community.
Let's talk a little bit about what could be the future of solar energy on the island, specifically some of the landscape, the business landscape here. There's been a big push from the Puerto Rican government now, after Maria, to embrace solar energy as it tries to rebuild its power grid. And I'm wondering if PREPA, or the Puerto Rican Electric Power Authority, which was heavily criticized after its faulty response to Maria, are they embracing moving forward with solar energy?
Both the government and PREPA, they are saying one thing, but they are acting differently. They want to gasify, to rebuild Puerto Rico energy grid fossil fuel dependent. And that's the problem, that Puerto Rico is 98% fossil fuel energy dependent. So that's not a transition to a different future.
So, Arturo, your work is being featured in this National Geographic documentary called From Paris to Pittsburgh. Are you taking your work beyond Adjuntas?
Yes, we have. That's very interesting. We're going to show that in our cinema, solar cinema, very soon in Puerto Rico. We are very pleased for the local people and for Puerto Rico to see that what is being done at the local level has a meaning for Puerto Rico, for the Caribbean, and for the whole planet. I think when you add what is going in Adjuntas, Casa Pueblo is one of these community organizations, but there's a lot of community organizations in Puerto Rico doing actively different efforts, as we see in Iowa and Florida and California. And when you add all of that and you break that sense of isolation and actually create a sense that what is being done here in Adjuntas, in this isolated area, has a very significant and important meaning for what is going on global-wise.
Arturo Masol Della is the Associate Director of Casa Pueblo. Arturo, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Paris to Pittsburgh premieres tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern on National Geographic. It may not be tax season, but there is a tax deadline looming for Americans who've been wrongly convicted of a crime. According to the National Registry of Exonerations, at least 139 people were exonerated in 2017. Some of those people receive financial compensation for the wrongful conviction through a state statute or a lawsuit. But few people know about the 2015 Wrongful Conviction Tax Relief Act, which states that that money isn't income, and the IRS can't touch it.
That law also did something pretty interesting, which is it retroactively offers an opportunity for anyone who paid any taxes at any time on that money to file and get a refund from the IRS, and the IRS will pay interest.
That's attorney John Eldon, the founder of After Innocence, a nonprofit that helps people who are wrongfully convicted after they're released. But the deadline to file for that refund is in just a few days, December 17th. And there are lots of exonerees who don't even know this refund is available to them. John Eldon wants to change that.
The unfortunate part is that there was really no effective way for the government to notify people of their eligibility. And so we had a situation where a lot of people were potentially eligible for this refund, but they didn't know about it. And the deadline was very short. And so I'd done my best to go out there and find people and notify them and provide them with the free assistance they need to claim those refunds before the deadline expires.
All right, so let's step back for a second. When we think about the population of people who are wrongfully convicted, I think often we have an image of the big stories that we hear in the news, right? Someone's wrongfully convicted, they get this huge payout and big settlement, and they move on. Is that the norm?
It isn't the norm, and I'm so glad you mentioned that, because people understandably expect that someone who can prove in court that they were in prison for a crime they didn't commit would be eligible for millions of dollars, and many of instances, these are people who spent years and even decades in prison, and that's really not the case. Whether you have a lawsuit depends on whether you can prove particular wrongdoing. That's not possible in some cases. It didn't happen in other cases. And so if you take a step back and look at the population of wrongfully incarcerated people who've been released, we find that the vast majority of them never get what you would call meaningful compensation, and also really never get any help rebuilding their lives after a wrongful conviction. On the other hand, some did get money, and those that did and who paid taxes are now eligible to get that money back.
So we know that there are some important deadlines coming up. What are the deadlines that people who fall into this category should be paying attention to?
Well, anyone who paid taxes on money received in 2014 or prior, money received in relation to wrongful conviction, needs to file their claim by December 17th, in a few days. And we have lawyers and tax preparers lined up to provide completely free assistance to anyone who is needing to file a claim. And we currently have about 15 claims that are in process and still have availability to help anybody else who comes our way.
Now, I'm sure there are folks who are probably in this category who are not aware that they are eligible for this. How do you find those people or get the message out to them? Obviously, talking to us is one way to do that. But beyond that, what other techniques are there?
Well, it's a lot of cold calling, actually. We have very good information about people who've received money in relation to wrongful conviction, because most of the time that's public record. So we know who they are. Tracking them down is very difficult. And once we do that, I have to pick up the phone and call them up and explain who I am, about my organization, and that they may be eligible for a tax refund. And the deadline is coming up and we've got to move quickly. That's a tall order in terms of convincing somebody in a time when we have a lot of tax scams and crazy calls going around. But fortunately, once I get someone on the phone, I have a very, very good chance of getting through to them and, if they're eligible, helping them.
Who is James Ochoa?
James Ochoa is an exoneree out of California who now lives in Texas, and he was one of the individuals that I was able to track down and call during the last period in which this tax relief window was open. It was in 2016. And that year, on the day of the deadline, I managed to finally get a hold of James. I got him on his cell phone at work. I quickly explained that we didn't have very much time, literally hours before the deadline was going to expire. And fortunately, we were able to get his claim going and by that afternoon get it completed. Unfortunately, by the time it was done, the deadline had already passed in Texas, but I still had some time in California. And working with a tax preparer in Michigan, I was able to print out his claim and make it to the FedEx office here in Oakland with 3 minutes to spare before it closed. So as you can hear, we will do everything we can to help someone not miss this deadline.
This is obviously a project and a something that's really important and that you're very passionate about. I'm curious, how much of a difference does this actually make in the life of someone who's been exonerated? Like, are we talking large sums of money, or does it matter?
Certainly, there are large sums of money. It really just depends on how much was paid. And because of interest, how long it's been since those taxes were paid. Because obviously, I've got one claim pending right now for someone who was exonerated in 1988. So the interest will be substantial on that one. So sometimes the money is large. We've had one claim in excess of $500,000. And we've had a claim that was down at a few thousand dollars. I've heard from recipients, that it made the difference between paying off debts, getting health care. But to me, what this also represents is not leaving these folks behind. In so many instances, we essentially turn our back on exonerees. They get pushed out the prison door. There aren't programs for them. Most of them don't receive meaningful compensation. And here's a situation in which Congress actually gave them something that could be quite valuable. And it's incredibly important to me to try and make the connection between that opportunity and the exonerees that are eligible.
You've also focused some of this work on exonerees who've also been in the military. Tell us a little bit about those efforts.
In connection with doing this work, we came across a group of exonerees that haven't received quite as much attention as exonerees out of civilian courts. And those are people in the military, service members who were convicted of a crime by a military court, sentenced to incarceration, who served part of that sentence, and then had their convictions overturned and the charges dismissed. In those instances, what the military does typically is reinstates them and they give them back pay. And we consulted with tax attorneys and took the position that even though it's called back pay, it shouldn't have been taxed because the real reason they were getting this money was because of the time they spent in confinement that was unjust or inappropriate. And so we've already assisted three service members who filed claims and were received refunds. And so this year, there was a massive effort that we undertook. We reviewed more than 2,000 military cases. It was the only way to identify them and managed already to find 24 military exonerees who we believe are eligible for refunds, and we're helping them at this moment. I just reached one literally this morning.
Well, I can tell you it is a fascinating topic, and I'm really curious to see how these work out. John Eldon is an attorney and founder of After Innocence, a nonprofit in Oakland, California, that helps people who are wrongfully convicted after they're released. John, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And that is The Takeaway for today. We hope you learned a few things with us. Reach out to us as well. We're on Facebook and Twitter at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.